The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. The People's Pharmacy, Joe and Teresa Graydon. Doctor recommends soap for leg cramps. Question. I recently heard from my vascular physician about using a bar of soap in between the sheets to alleviate nocturnal leg cramps. I began charting the frequency of my leg cramps since I started using the bed soap. I am now down to zero. I have not had any leg cramps for the past 3 months. I am amazed. I just read that the need to change the soap once the scent fades. I am now a happy and well-rested woman who does not get up in the middle of the night because of extreme muscle cramping. Whatever it is, even if mind over matter, this method has worked for me. Answer? Thank you for sharing the story. We have been writing about putting soap under the bottom sheet for more than a decade. Hearing that a physician is recommending this home remedy is gratifying. We do not think this is a placebo effect, though many people believe that is the explanation. A physician actually tested a skin patch containing soap-scented oil to ease muscular spasms, menstrual cramps, and the pain of fibromyalgia, and that's cited in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, July 2008, as well as the Journal of Multidisciplinary Healthcare, September 1, 2008. He got good results. Scientists report that soap scent may inhibit pain by activating special TRPA1 channels. That's cited in the European Journal of Pain, August 2016. Even if incorrect, a bar of soap under the bottom sheet seems like a safe possible solution for a problem. Question. Due to cancer, my thyroid was removed. I've been on Synthroid ever since, despite telling my endocrinologist that I'm tired all the time. Within an hour of taking Synthroid, I'm ready to go back to sleep. I have asked my doctor for either Armour Thyroid or Nature Thyroid, but yet nowhere. Is there any research that might convince her? Answer. There is research showing that some people do not convert T4, Synthroid, to the active T3 hormone. That's in Nature Reviews, Endocrinology, November 2015. Our Guide to Thyroid Hormones and our one-hour radio show, Thyroid Mysteries, Controversies, and the Latest Research, show number 1015, may change your doctor's mind. Pharmacy refuses to replace recalled blood pressure drug. Question. What can you tell me about the Valsartan recall? I've been taking the Solco product for some time. When I spoke with the pharmacist yesterday, I was brushed off as if there was no problem. He acted as if the recall wasn't a big deal and they were doing nothing about it. Should we customers call the Food and Drug Administration for advice? I am concerned about continuing to take the 90-day prescription. Answer, Valsartan, brand name Divan, is a widely prescribed heart and blood pressure medicine. The recall is a big deal. Some generic Valsartan pills were contaminated with NDMA, a probable carcinogen. A Chinese company, Zhengcheng Huao, sold the contaminated Valsartan to a number of generic drug manufacturers around the world. Solco Healthcare U.S. is a subsidiary of Huchao. Other U.S. companies affected include Major Pharmaceuticals and Teva's Actavis Valsartan. The FDA states that, quote, patients taking the recall Valsartan-containing medicines should continue taking their medicine until they have a replacement product, unquote. Your pharmacy should provide you unaffected Valsartan at no extra cost. If there are shortages, your doctor could prescribe a similar medication such as Irbesartan, Losartan, Olmesartan, or Temesartan. Our Guide to Blood Pressure Treatment provides information on such medications, along with a number of non-drug options. It is available at peoplespharmacy.com. Question. Nasal Crom actually works better for me than allergy pills that cause side effects. I've been telling everyone about it for several years. It gets a lot of word-of-mouth recommendations. Maybe that is why we don't see a huge advertising budget for it. The nasal spray takes several days to kick in, but then it is wonderful. Rather than addressing symptoms you already have, it prevents you from having the symptoms in the first place. I now am back to being a person who just doesn't have allergies. Answer, Chromalin, which is nasal Chrom, stabilizes mast cells in the nose. These cells release histamine and other compounds when exposed to pollen and other allergens. Many other readers also report that nasal Chrom nasal spray helps reduce or prevent allergy symptoms. Washington Post by Jill Adams, doctors wary of giving fruit juice to children. How much fruit juice should kids drink? Not very much. That's the essence of the juice policy statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics. School-aged children 7 to 18 years old should limit consumption to 8 ounces a day. Preschoolers ages 4 to 6 can have 4 to 6 ounces a day, while toddlers ages 1 to 3 should have no more than 4 ounces a day. And babies should not drink any juice at all. Given that most Americans need to increase the amount of fruit and vegetables in their diets, and that good diet habits can be established during childhood, why is juice so worrisome? The recommendations are centered around two arguments, explains Stephen Abrams, a pediatrician at the University of Texas at Austin, and one of the authors of the policy statement. Fruit juice is fruit with the fiber and some vitamins taken out, and it's damaging to the teeth. Some pediatricians say no juice at all. I think that's a bit tough. It is a fruit serving. When Gary Leroy, a family physician in Dayton, Ohio, sees his youngest patients, he appeals to parents' common sense. An excessive amount of anything is not good, he says. Moderation is the key. Leroy helped create a program with his county's public health board called 5210. The name refers to 5 daily servings of fruit and veggies, a 2-hour limit on screen time, 1 hour of physical activity, and 0 sugary drinks. It's a simple rule of thumb for a healthy lifestyle for all county residents. As for fruit juice specifically, Leroy says, if you use juice to count as one of the fruit and vegetable servings, then make sure it is 100% fruit juice. There are pure juices, and then there are juice beverages or cocktails. The latter typically has some added ingredients such as sugars and preservatives. Anything labeled 100% fruit juice comes only from fruit. That means no added sugar. But that doesn't mean no sugar at all. A 4.23 ounce juice box of Mott's apple juice contains 14 grams of sugar. And the same size serving of white grape juice from Apple and Eve has 15 grams. That's more than 3 teaspoons worth. A 6-ounce box of Minute Maid orange juice contains 18 grams of sugar, similar to the same size serving of Coca-Cola, 19.5 grams, and half a 12-ounce can, all added sugar in this case. Leroy says his practice has a display just outside the exam rooms that shows the total amount of sugar in sodas, energy drinks, and fruit juices. Our patients see how much sugar is in these drinks, he says. The display triggers discussion in the exam room. It's hard to know exactly how the advice to limit juice is being followed by American families and whether they think it is too restrictive. Pancreatic cancer cases rise, a deadly trend. This is by Jane Brody from the New York Times. As an avid reader of obituaries, I've been struck by how many people these days are succumbing to pancreatic cancer, a cancer long considered rare. And relatively speaking, it is still rare, accounting for just 3% of all cancers. But it is also one of the deadliest because symptoms almost never develop until the disease is advanced and incurable. Although 55,440 cases affecting 29,200 men and 26,240 women are expected to be diagnosed this year in the United States, 44,330 people will die of it, often within months of diagnosis, making it the fourth leading cause of cancer deaths in this country after lung, colorectal, and breast cancer. Furthermore, it is on track to become the second most deadly cancer by 2030. At the same time, cases of pancreatic cancer are rising, even though the leading known risk factor, cigarette smoking, has been declining for decades. That fact alone has prompted researchers to seek explanations for other causes, and it is hoped find ways, in addition to quitting smoking, to prevent it and detect it while still curable. In most of the approximately 6% of five-year survivors, pancreatic cancer is discovered early, quite by accident, usually during a scan or surgery for some other reason. For example, in 2009, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the Supreme Court had part of her pancreas removed after a routine CT scan revealed a 1 centimeter lesion. While that lesion was benign, a smaller tumor the surgeon found was malignant and had not yet spread beyond the pancreas. The pancreas is a small two-part glandular organ about 7 inches long and 1.5 inches wide in the upper abdomen behind the stomach. It performs two vital functions. One part of the gland is a source of digestive enzymes, and the other part produces the hormones insulin and glucagon that control blood levels of glucose and fatty acids. Some known risk factors for pancreatic cancer are beyond an individual's control. Older age, being an African American or Ashkenazi Jew, and having two or more first-degree relatives, parents, or siblings who have had the cancer. But it is the modifiable risk factors that are of greatest concern. Aside from tobacco smoking, which accounts for 20% to 25% of pancreatic cancers, even as this risk continues to decline, the main risks for pancreatic cancer cases and deaths are obesity, type 2 diabetes, and metabolic syndrome, all of which have risen to epidemic levels in recent years. Data gathered in many studies clearly show a relationship to obesity, says Doogie Lee, a molecular epidemiologist at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. The higher the BMI, the greater the risk of pancreatic cancer, she said, referring to body mass index. Obesity contributes to both onset and progression of this cancer. Lee added, the distribution of fat also plays a role. The higher the waist-to-hip ratio, the greater the risk. She found that cancer risk was greater the earlier in life a person becomes obese, and survival time was shorter among those who were still obese when the cancer was diagnosed. Obesity is also the leading risk factor for the development of type 2 diabetes, in which the body resists the action of insulin, prompting the pancreas to produce more and more of this hormone. Insulin promotes cell growth, providing a link between diabetes and the development of pancreatic cancer. However, the relationship is complicated. In a 2011 report in Molecular Carcinogenesis, Lee noted that diabetes or impaired glucose tolerance is present in 50 to 80% of patients with pancreatic cancer. She said, diabetes is both a cause and consequence of cancer, although which comes first, diabetes or cancer in the organ that controls blood glucose, is not crystal clear. A European study of more than 800,000 people with type 2 diabetes found this disease is sometimes an early sign of otherwise hidden pancreatic cancer. In studies at the Mayo Clinic, elevated glucose levels, a condition called prediabetes, were detected in some patients 2 years before pancreatic cancer was diagnosed. In these patients, Lee explained, diabetes is actually a symptom of the hidden cancer. It is a type of diabetes called 3C caused by a diseased or damaged pancreas, and medical researchers are seeking ways for doctors to readily distinguish between type 3C and type 2 diabetes. The lag time between the development of diabetes and diagnosis of cancer is a potential window of opportunity that may enable cancer detection at an early curable stage, Lee said. Mayo Clinic Health Letter, Kidney Stones, Personalized Prevention. After the painful ordeal of passing a second kidney stone, you'd dearly like to prevent yet another. You've already been drinking more water. What else can you do? You might be surprised. In recent years, management of kidney stones has become increasingly more precise and targeted to individual circumstances. Imaging advances are making it easier to tell whether a procedure is needed to remove a stone and which procedure will result in the best outcome. Lowering the risk of stones is being helped along by steady advances in understanding the factors that go into stone formation. Discovering the underlying cause of a stone guides a tailored approach to preventing another. Crystallization. Kidney stones are made up of crystals formed from minerals in the urine. Most of the time, with adequate hydration, urine is diluted and the crystals either don't form or are passed naturally and harmlessly out of the body. In addition, normal urine also contains substances that inhibit crystal formation. However, there are a number of ways that this balance can be upset. These include an increase in the amount of minerals that end up in the urine being dehydrated, or when the inhibitors of crystal formation don't work properly or are absent. However it happens, crystals may gradually accumulate, anchor to the inner wall of the kidney, and grow into a stone. At some point, the stone may become dislodged and pass from the kidney through the tube or the ureter, connecting the kidney to the bladder. Finally, the stone is eliminated from the body when it passes out of the bladder and through the urethra. Some kidney stones may pass with little or no pain. However, some stones can cause extreme waves of pain. The pain can occur in the side and back and just below the rib cage and radiate to the lower abdomen and groin. Additional signs and symptoms may include blood in the urine, which often makes the urine look pink, nausea and vomiting, a persistent urge to urinate, or pain with urination. If an infection is present, some people experience a fever and chills. Letting it pass. Most people appropriately seek care for a kidney stone due to the extreme pain that can occur. Subduing pain is typically the first step. Don't try to ride out a suspected stone without medical care. A number of other serious problems cause symptoms similar to those of kidney stones and shouldn't be overlooked. An initial evaluation of suspected kidney stone passage involves basic laboratory and urine testing to look for signs of infection and to determine how your kidneys are functioning. A low-dose computerized tomography or CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis can confirm stone location and size and the degree of urinary obstruction. A special type of CT scan called a dual energy CT, a type routinely performed at the Mayo Clinic and many major hospitals and medical centers, can frequently identify the mineral composition of the stone. If you're one of the roughly 10 to 15% of people who have a kidney stone composed of uric acid, this is important upfront information. Taking a medication such as potassium citrate to alkalize the urine can help dissolve, sometimes fully, a uric acid stone without the need for surgery or painful passage. If your pain can be controlled, you have no other complications, and the stone is fairly small in size, you'll likely be sent home to let the stone work through your urinary system. This can take anywhere from hours to weeks, with 2 to 4 weeks being a fairly common time frame. During that time, drink at least 8 to 12 cups of water daily to increase urine flow. Use standard non-prescription pain relievers to control pain or stronger pain medications as prescribed. And finally, you may be prescribed a drug such as Tamsulosin or Flomax to relax ureter muscles and facilitate stone passage. Break it up. About 10 to 20% of the time, additional measures are needed to remove a stone. Sometimes this call can be made by assessing the size and location of a stone with a CT scan. Other times, these measures are needed if there are complications or if a stone hasn't passed on naturally after a month or two. Steps include, number one, extracorporeal shockwaves lithotripsy. This outpatient procedure uses high-energy shock waves to break the stone into tiny pieces that can be more easily passed. It works best with smaller stones that are less dense and located high in the ureter or in the kidney. Ureteroscopic stone removal. This outpatient procedure uses a small scope instrument to pass into the ureter to remove a large stone. Often a laser or other device is used to break apart a stone before removal. Newer flexible scopes can reach and remove stones in the upper reaches of the ureters and even some stones within the kidneys. There are no incisions with this surgery, and people typically are dismissed the same day. This is often used for several small or a single medium-sized stone. Percutaneous nephrolithotomy. This minimally invasive surgery is performed through a tiny incision about a third of an inch long and uses special telescoping instruments to remove larger stones. This procedure generally requires an overnight hospital stay. Individualized options. Once you have one kidney stone, there's roughly a 50% chance that you'll pass another within 10 years. The fact alone puts the spotlight on preventing the painful ordeal of additional future stones. In addition, recurrent kidney stones may slightly increase your risk of future kidney disease. Determining the composition of a kidney stone is a key step. This can be done by capturing the stone in a strainer as it passes by, analyzing urine for crystals or chemical imbalances. Well over half of kidney stones are formed primarily of calcium oxalate. Calcium phosphate is the main component of around 10 to 15% of stones, with a roughly equal percentage made of pure uric acid. The small percentage of remaining stones are struvite stones caused by a bacterial infection or one of several rarer forms such as cysteine stones. A thorough medical history or other testing can look for potentially modifiable risks associated with an increased kidney stone risk, such as certain dietary habits, the use of certain drugs or supplements, chronic diarrhea, digestive diseases, weight loss surgery, chronic kidney disease, diabetes, or hyperparathyroidism. Your doctor may also want you may want to get an individualized assessment of your future risk of kidney stones. This can be done with a Mayo-developed risk calculating tool called Recurrence of Kidney Stone, ROKS ROCKS, which is found on a free smartphone app called Calculate by QXMD. Taken together, individualized information can help target prevention efforts with steps that may include, number one, drinking at least 8 to 12 cups of that fluid daily. This is the most basic and, in general, the most important preventive step applicable to nearly any stone type or situation. Water is a great choice, as sugary drinks may increase stone risk. A good rule of thumb is if your urine is clear like water, you're likely well hydrated. If it's dark yellow, then more fluid intake is needed. Second, maintaining a healthy weight and controlling diabetes. If weight loss is necessary, do so gradually, emphasizing minimally processed plant foods, portion control, and exercise. Third, limiting animal proteins to less than 6 ounces daily. Animal-based protein contributes to stone formation in several ways, while plant proteins don't appear to do so. Four, reducing sodium intake. This reduces the amount of calcium excreted into the urine, lowering the risk of calcium-based stones. Five, meeting daily calcium requirements for your age. For most people, getting the appropriate amount of calcium is best done through diet. If your doctor knows about your kidney stone risk and recommends a calcium supplement, such as may occur if you have had weight loss surgery or other gastrointestinal surgery, take the supplement with meals. And then finally, specific drugs to inhibit stone formation. A thiazide diuretic decreases the amount of calcium in the urine. Potassium citrate can help lower uric acidity, inhibits crystal formation in urine. Allopurinol or Xylaprim can lower uric acid levels if they're too high. Theoponin or thiola is a cysteine binding agent to reduce the risk of cysteine stones. Health tips. Bust the dust. Exposure to dust mites can stir up chronic conditions, including allergies and asthma. Use these tips to keep your exposure to dust mites at a minimum. Number one, reduce humidity. Dust mites thrive in high humidity, Keep your home humidity between 30 to 50% using a well-maintained dehumidifier or central air conditioning. 2, cover mattresses and pillows. Dustproof or allergen-blocking covers are available to enclose the parts of your bed that can't easily be washed. 3, wash bedding often. Wash your sheets and blankets each week, preferably in hot water. Cold or warm water in combination with detergent and bleach also can kill dust mites. 4, vacuum often. Vacuum carpets and fabric-covered furniture weekly. Consider using a vacuum cleaner with a high-efficiency particulate air, HEPA, filter, which may capture larger airborne particles such as dust. Don't clean with dry tools. Use a damp moth or cloth instead of a broom or dry cloth to reduce the amount of dust stirred up. 6, replace carpets and curtains. If you're especially susceptible to dust mites, consider replacing the carpet in your bedroom and main living areas with hard surfaces such as wood or tile. If you need a window covering, consider blinds that can be dusted. And then finally, be wary of air filters. There's little evidence that these improve allergy and asthma symptoms. Your best bet is to focus on the cleaning tips above. And then question from Second Opinion. My daughter awoke to find a bat in her bedroom the other night. She doesn't think she was bitten, but I wonder whether she should have been seen by a doctor to be safe. Yes, she should have. Anytime there's a possibility of direct contact between a person and a bat, preventive treatment for rabies and other infections should occur immediately. Treatment can only be avoided if the person is absolutely sure that a bat bite, scratch, or exposure to mucous membranes, including the mouth, nose, and eyelids, didn't occur. Since a sleeping person or a child, mentally disabled person, or intoxicated person can't be certain or express with certainty that an exposure didn't occur, it is important to take action. Since rabies vaccination isn't routinely given, most people will not have received it. It's an ideal situation. A bat in the home should be collected. In an ideal situation, a bat in the home should be collected by your local animal control or wildlife conservation agency and submitted for rabies testing. If you attempt to capture and secure the bat in a box yourself, use leather gloves for protection. If rabies is ruled out in the bat, it's likely that no treatment will be needed. However, if the bat can't be captured, contact your doctor immediately about preventive treatment. If you haven't been vaccinated against rabies, management of a possible exposure with or without a wound involves an antibody and a vaccine series. A dose of the antibody human rabies immune globulin, or HRIG, immediately inactivates the virus. The rabies vaccine is typically given in 4 doses. Wounds from a bat bite or scratch can cause concerns besides rabies. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comment or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138, and stay healthy.